Hey, this is Richard Deitch of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Coming up today, our guest is Jessica Luther. She is the author of Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football, and the Politics of Rape.
Sports Illustrated presents the Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. Now, your host, Richard Deitch.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch, and my guest today is the author and writer, Jessica Luther. Her new book is Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football, and the Politics of Rape. Jessica Luther is one of the preeminent voices on this topic in terms of reporting on college football, sexual assault, rape. These are stories, as you know, have been in the news significantly, most with Baylor. She was at the forefront of that reporting, and I'm looking forward to talking to her on just how she has approached this reporting, which is not easy, both emotionally as well as the actual practitioner of finding these stories, going through legal and criminal documents, and obviously and most importantly, talking to victims and doing that with sympathy in print. So let's bring on Jessica Luther, the author of Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football, and the Politics of Rape. Jessica, thank you very much for being part of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start with a sort of an overarching question, and that is how difficult is it to cover accusations of sexual assault and rape on campus?
It's hard. It's hard to do it because just the work of it can be difficult, you know, getting documents, getting stories, getting the full thing all at once. But it's also just really hard to take in other people's trauma. And when you start doing it, people send you lots of stories. And so it sort of feels like it exponentially multiplies as you go. Just today, I had multiple emails. People send me tweets of terrible things all the time. So there's a lot to take in, as well as the actual work you're doing.
How do you think this is being covered nationally? Are there enough reporters on the beat to tell the stories of what is happening on college campuses across the country with specifics to college athletics being involved in sexual assault and rape?
I mean, I think it's getting better nationally. I think, you know, over the last few years, we're having a cultural conversation about sexual violence that feels different to me. I always get nervous saying that it is different, but it does seem to be better. I do think, you know, no, there's not enough people who see this as a beat. It's a hard beat, but I think most of the people, especially in sports media that are covering this, are sports people who do this as through the lens of sport itself. You know, I think of myself as a sports person, but I don't think that's how I cover this topic. And I've talked to friends about this who don't have anything to do with sports that care about this issue. And, you know, there should be a sexual assault, domestic violence, violence against women kind of beat that people come at for these kind of stories, because the amount of information and knowledge you have to have in order to really contextualize this stuff is intense. There's a lot to know about consent and trauma and, you know, in my case, Title IX, how universities work, how police departments work, how law courts work, how civil suits work. Like, these are all things that you have to have an understanding about in order to write about these cases, which is why I think people struggle when they come to it and their normal beat is like covering what happens on the field or within the team on the sidelines, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting suggestion as to whether that should be a beat in especially big university towns. I imagine, and you would know this better than me, the problem is there could be backlash from local advertisers who don't want to buy into a newspaper that covers that, not to mention, and this is the real one, how difficult that would be for a reporter, particularly in a college town, fervent college town where college football is king. I'm sure you've come across this. We'll talk about Baylor and your reporting there. But that's always, I always take note of when a reporter in one of these towns does this kind of reporting, because it's so hard to do. You do the reporting and then you will see people walking around in your local supermarket. It's one thing to be a national reporter and parachute in. It's a whole other thing to do this kind of reporting. And then the people you were reporting on, they literally might drive by your house. That's what makes it very tough, I think, in these college communities where the power of football is so great.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's a community, right? And you have to be a part of it, you know, and it's also difficult as a job. Like, one of the things that I always joke about is that I'll never really have the access that I want, because a big part of this work, especially in sports, is like having access to people. And, you know, I feel like all I do is destroy my ability to ever get access to anything. So if that's like your beat, if that's your, you know, how you survive financially is to cover these things, that, you know, that would be difficult both in the community itself, but also just for your job.
How did you get involved in this kind of reporting? Was there a particular story that first drew you to this? Is it something that happened within your personal life? But I always wonder if when those who report about this kind of stuff, it's always interesting to me how they got involved in it, because many times they were just a football fan prior to this, and then they start reporting on it and they see the underbelly of what exists. So was there something that triggered this, a story or something personally that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I was already, it was on my radar back in 2013, sexual violence as an issue, and I know survivors. I knew survivors at that point. I know way more survivors now, but I cared about that issue. And then I care about college football. And the summer of 2013 was a particularly strange time for this, because we had the breaking news out of Nashville with the Vanderbilt team. Four players were arrested for sexually assaulting a fellow student, a fifth one arrested as, I think, accomplice after the fact. I can't remember the exact thing. And then there was a trial ongoing with three Navy players who were accused of or charged with raping a fellow midshipman. I think they were all found not guilty in the end. But those two stories were sort of happening simultaneously is my memory of it. And all anyone in sports was talking about was whether or not Johnny Manziel was paid for his autograph.
Right.
And I just remembered that was the first moment where the dissonance of what we see in college football is important really hit me. I was like, how can we seven players at, or eight, I guess, eight players at two different major programs with, you know, charged with the exact same crime, which is horrific. And like, it was almost crickets, except for local coverage in both of those places. And then for me, the big one was November 2013 is when Jameis Winston was, when the news broke that he had been under investigation for 11 months for sexual assault of a fellow student. And I went to Florida State. I grew up, my dad went to Florida State, so I grew up as a Florida State football fan. I went to games all the time with, you know, we watched them, we would go to them. And then when I went, when I applied for college, that was the only school I applied to go to. And then I went to every single home football game. Even one time when I was on crutches and I was told not to go, I still went. I was a dedicated Florida State football fan and very excited about the team in 2013 because we'd been very bad for about 5 years. And we were suddenly very good again. And he was a big part of it, Winston. And so then when that case broke, I was reading it both because I was, that issue was already on my radar, but also just because I was a fan and I was following. And I didn't really like the coverage. I didn't like how much was about him and his athletic ability and how this was going to affect the team. Even though as a fan, I cared about that. And I started, that was when I first started intervening in the conversation. And I just sort of haven't stopped since then.
And in Jessica's book, Unsportsmanlike Conduct, you read about that. It's, I think, Jessica, you even admit in the, as you're writing the book, you're sort of working through your own childhood fandom of FSU as you are reporting on the case of Jameis Winston, which obviously became a national story. So that, and you address that in the book, and that's, I think that readers will find that interesting, and because there'll be a lot of similarities to people who are, grew up as longtime fans of certain college teams, and then, you know, they recognize that everything is not sort of as sunshine and rosy as one might expect. You know, there are a lot of young writers and reporters who listen to this podcast, and they will not have had much, if any, experience in reporting about sexual violence, sexual assault, and rape. You can go as long as you want on this, but can you sort of take us through what your checklist would be in terms of how to report this stuff, and particularly the important things reporters should know as they're reporting this stuff?
Yeah, I can try. I think the number one thing is that you have to see it outside of sports. Like, you have to move away from the idea of centering the athlete in your story. And I think that opens you up to a lot of stuff. It can be difficult because most of the time the women in these cases are anonymous. Sometimes I get tips and I know who that person is, or, you know, if often if you actually go look at the court documents at the courthouse, you learn a whole lot more. So that's a big part of it, is figuring out how to get as much documentation as possible, figuring out if it's a public university, you can request documentation from the university itself. You can do that with a private university. You just probably won't get anywhere. I mean, you should do that, but you might not get anywhere. You know, go to the local police department, start requesting all the documents you can, you know, look up to see if they've actually been indicted. There's different documentation in clerk's offices. You know, I do bunch of I love documents. I collect like as much as possible. I read everything I can. And so that's true about any individual case. And then there's just sort of like the larger stuff that I mentioned before. Like you have to read up on how all of this stuff is in there, how it works. Like if you end up reporting on a sexual violence case that takes place on a college campus, like you need to read about how Title IX is supposed to work, how it often works, you know, contact the Title IX coordinator for that school, interview them. There are really great experts, law experts, who can talk you through this kind of stuff. And I still do that. I still get confused about Title IX in a different case each time. So I'll end up calling someone and just saying, can you please tell me if this is how it's supposed to work? And I mean, I just did that for something recently. And then it's important to read about trauma, how trauma works. A lot of what we do in sexual violence cases is talk about whether or not she's changed her story, the woman who's reported. And obviously she's changed it. That means she's lying. This is a, you know, a huge cultural narrative, but trauma is really confusing and it makes people tell confusing stories. And it makes it that police don't understand how to deal with trauma either. So I read a lot about how police do investigations and how those falter. I mean, I try to talk to as many people as I can on the campus who are related to the story, you know, and if I can, I try to talk to the victim in every case. If I know who that person is, I have a whole process for contacting them. We can talk about that if you'd like, you know, and of course I always do my journalistic duty, which is if I'm going to report on a story and the guy has been named and not convicted, right? Like I'm going to contact him. They almost never contact you to talk to you.
Right.
But you can often find them through their lawyers and you contact their lawyer and you get a statement from the lawyer and you know, you try to do that work, tell the full story. Did that answer the question?
It does. Yeah. I would be interested though. And because again, I think this is important. So what are your steps in contacting a victim where obviously this is a very traumatic thing that people have mm-hmm. to talk about. So you have to approach this, I think, with a certain empathy and I imagine as a reporter, there's, especially for someone you don't know, there's a way to approach it so that the person talking to you can ultimately gain some trust to answer the questions that you have for them.
Right. So there's two different things. So there's times when people come to me directly, and so that's a little bit different. I often will offer to talk to them off the record the first time so that they don't have to worry about exactly how they're going to say everything to me so I can get a sense of the story. And that will allow me to start doing all the other investigation that I do around it. And then we'll start doing the on the record stuff. But I do try to make them feel comfortable to talk to me at the beginning without all the worry of whether or not that exact quote's going to end up somewhere. But if I'm contacting someone out of the blue, I try to do it like via email or something like that so that they have a chance to process it. I worry a lot about triggering someone. I mean, we're talking about people who often have PTSD, I worry about suicidal people and participating in any of that. So I try to be very clear in my emails that I often say something like, I heard that you have a story about, you know, that you went to the school. You know, I'm writing about, you know, Title IX, sexual violence on campus. I heard that you might have a story to tell. If you'd like to talk about it, I would be more than happy to talk about it. We can do that off the record if you'd like to, you know, and then I will sometimes sort of give my credentials if they want to read something I've written to see how I report on this, something like that. But I don't want to, like, you know, if I've heard stories about what happened to them, I don't ever give details of the rumors that I've heard or something like that. I try to leave it open-ended. Sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. And I just have to let it go. Like, I have discussions with myself, like, if I find their phone number at work, do I call this person at work and possibly, like what would that do to them if they really do have sort of psychological trauma? It's really difficult, and I feel like I'm constantly navigating it, and it can be scary to do it. But I try to show empathy, be clear that I'm a reporter, I'm working on a story, this is what it's about, do you want to talk about it? And this is who I am.
And one of the factors here, Jessica, obviously, is that you're usually dealing with young people, right? People under the age of 22. So that's a significant factor in all this. You're not only are you talking to people who have had trauma or believe they've been traumatized, but they're at times they're also not fully fledged adults, right? You're talking about young people who are still trying to figure it out beyond this incident, which really makes it a tough situation for the reporter as well, I would imagine.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, I talk to them at first and I let them tell their story however they want to tell it. And then, you know, we go on record. That's clear. This is what we're doing. And then I start questioning them. And this can be a lot. This is a lot. Just if you ever end up interviewing someone who's experienced trauma, especially sexual violence, they will expect you not to believe them. And so this is a really difficult thing to do as a reporter because your job is to question them. So they'll tell you something and they'll get the timeline strange. So you say, wait a second, can you back up? I got confused. Was that in the spring or was that in the fall? And you have to do that, right? Like, that's my job. And then I have to prepare them to be fact-checked as well, right? Because that's part of this too. But you're also dealing with someone who expects you not to believe them the whole time. And that can, I feel like I learn every time how to do this better as I go, but it can be very difficult and treacherous, and it's hard for you as a journalist because you want to do your job correctly and you want the story fact-checked and you want it solid for you, for them, for, you know, the reporting itself. But also the very person that you're talking to has all the reason not to trust you. They won't trust you. It's been quite a thing to sort of figure out as I go. And I do feel like I'm constantly learning how to do it better.
In your experience, how forthcoming have college administrators and particularly athletic department administrators been when you have called or your reporting partners have called to ask them about incidents that involve people within their athletic community?
It's very hard to get any information. And part of that is because there's, you know, FERPA, the Federal it's the Privacy Act. It's the Education Privacy Act. And that's a really easy go-to. You know, and that's another thing you have to study. Like, I have interviewed FERPA experts to figure out if a school is right in how they're the blocking that they're doing of documents or discussion or whatever. So most of the time what happens is if I contact someone, it almost exclusively goes to email. It gets funneled to a media person on the campus, like almost 100%. Like, I will email directly the person that I want to talk to, and the person who responds will be the media communications person. It's almost all via statements. It's very hard to get documents. That can take a long time. And so, yeah, I have very little access. I don't really get to talk to the people that I would love to talk to about these issues. So I don't expect that anymore. I do all the work. I do it every time. I do all the follow-ups. But it's very hard for me to get any information in those spaces.
I understand this is a subjective question, and different reporters may have different answers. But when it comes to let's say a college football coach and someone, a player under him, has been accused of sexual assault or violence or rape, what do you see as the responsibility of that college football coach, both for the player's action, but more than that, towards talking to the media about a particular arrest or allegation?
I think I would feel better. I understand, you know, coaches know these guys, they're familiar with them, they feel protective of them. But I think it's hard for me to listen to a coach just like dismiss the violence that's been reported against the player. And so I almost just wish it was like, we don't know enough to say what has happened here. You know, this has been reported, the violence is bad, but we're going to wait and see what happens. This person's been suspended, whatever that thing is. I just feel like most of the time when they're talking, they don't even really acknowledge that anything has happened, that there's a person who's reported, it's almost always a woman, but a woman has reported this thing, like that she doesn't even exist in their universe when they talk about this issue. And I feel like there would just be a different tenor if that's how they approached it. And I get why I understand so well why they are protective of their player. But as university, they also work for the same university that this woman often does, right? And so they're an official of that too. And I don't have the right words right now, but I just feel like most of the time you don't even think that they recognize that she's part of this.
Jessica, you and Dan Solomon working together for Texas Monthly, I think really changed the conversation on what happened at Baylor and ultimately the result of what happened at Baylor, in addition to some players being convicted of sexual assault. Art Briles, obviously, I think resigning or being fired, however it's termed. But the interesting thing to me about this is, and in your book, you write how you were sitting at your office in Austin, Texas. You got a tip in August of 2015, was that without your reporting, I think nationally, this would not have come out at Baylor, or at least certainly not would not have come out at Baylor as large as it did. So now that you look back on it, was this missed by local newspapers, or was the culture in Waco so great that football sort of rules everything, and you know, it's a bit of like there were no rules at Baylor for athletes and football players. Now that you've mm-hmm. you sort of could step away from it a little bit, why do you think this, I don't want to say wasn't totally not reported, but it certainly was not reported nearly as much as it should have been?
Well, it wasn't reported in Waco local media until August 5th, 2015, which I know that date off the top of my head because that was the day that I got the tip. And Dan and I couldn't find him. I got the tip and it said he was going to go to trial for assault. And I couldn't find anything. And I thought that was such a weird thing to tell me he was going to go to trial and there'd be no record of that. Like, if you're, you know, if that for somehow wasn't true, what a weird thing to say was happening. And so it was actually Dan who found them on the trial docket. He's better at Google. I don't know. Bless Dan's heart. He's so good at Googling. And we got in the car and we went to Waco that afternoon. It's about an hour and a half from here. And it was when we were driving home that day after getting all the seeing all the documents for the first time in the case file at the clerk's office, that the first article went up at the Waco Tribune. So, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know what happened. Like, I don't know if they got the same tip. Like, maybe they got the same tip the day before, so it happened to go up the next day when we also got the tip. So, you know, I don't know why it took that long. I mean, this was almost 2 years after she initially reported. And she reported to the police that, you know, in October 2013, and he was indicted in June 2014. And then the other sort of wrinkle for me when I think about this is that in the summer of 2015, another player was actually arrested and put in county jail for this trial, his main witness. And like that didn't even make the news either, right? And so it's just very strange, but I don't have a good grasp on what was going on there at the time, that it just didn't end up in the paper until August 5th. It's strange, and I wish I had a better answer for people.
Jessica, now that Art Briles has stepped down, and he's sort of on a rehabilitation tour, talking to ESPN, we'll obviously be talking to others. It's very clear he wants a job again in college football. When you look at Art Briles, what are your observations about, one, his responsibility at Baylor, and two, should Art Briles or people like Art Briles, should they be in charge of another Division I college football program?
I mean, I think he had a responsibility. I mean, I write in the book about the fact that I think one way to start changing the system that I have problems with is that people at the top have to be held accountable. And I wrote that chapter before everything sort of went down at Baylor. So I was pleased to see that that's how the university handled it. I think that is one step in the right direction. But yeah, I mean, Baylor is so, it's so interesting because we just know so much about what happened there. We just don't sort of get, you know, so it's like, is this an anomaly? Like, was this absolutely the worst case scenario here where, I mean, they've had two players convicted, a third is going to go on trial. I mean, that alone is wild. That's a, I mean, I've seen sentences like only two have been convicted. And I'm like, only? Like, that's, it's hard to convict people on this crime at all. Forget, you know, two players from the same, under the same coach back-to-back years, you know. And we're about to have the third player. And then all the other players who've been mentioned as accused now, I think it's up to 8, 9. I lost count. So I think it's important that we say, like, what's going on in this space? That this is happening with some of these guys repeatedly and nothing is happening. Like, they're not even being suspended from the team. Everything is very reactive. I think it's good to say, like, that, you know, we're so quick to say coaches are responsible for players when they do great things. Like, oh, but we can see the influence on the coach on him. That's so great that he's doing these good things in the world. As soon as they do something bad, we're like, oh, he's an individual. He's divorced from context. There's nothing there except his own behavior. You know, I, whether or not Briles should coach again, you know, I think he will. So I don't know whether or not, like, weird to whether or not I have an opinion on whether or not he should be able to. I, you know, I wish that we knew more from him. I want specifics. I wish that, you know, he says he's sorry, that he takes responsibility, that he made mistakes. I would really like to understand what that means to him, responsibility and mistakes, what those things actually are. And then, you know, I would really, it would mean a lot to me to hear someone like Art Briles tell us what he's learned. Like, what's different? What's going to be different at the next place when he coaches? I think that could just be so useful, both in us trusting him again, if that's even possible. For some people, it never will be. But also for other coaches and other programs, I think it would be really great to have a better understanding from him.
Yeah, that's well said. From my own personal view, and it's a bit cynical, I feel like Art Briles is simply following the playbook of guys who want to get another job. But that's my opinion, obviously not yours.
Sure.
I want to ask you one thing about Jameis Winston.
Okay.
As we finish up on a couple of questions here. And again, the guest is Jessica Luther. Her book is Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape. Google that title and it'll come up on Amazon and many other places. And you could follow her on Twitter as well. I highly recommend it. You are at SCATX. Am I right about that? Okay.
Yeah, you are.
That is your Twitter handle. One of the things about Jameis Winston, and maybe this is sort of the inevitability of a news cycle or people's short attention spans, is that it feels like the case at Florida State has been forgotten. I don't know where things stand with a civil case. You probably know better than me. I know the Hunting Ground came out, obviously put a little spotlight on him. But as a general rule, people have forgotten about this. And you may have whatever, however you feel about Jameis Winston. And reading, I'm not going to lie, reading your book, I would be hard-pressed for people who read your book not to feel a certain way about what happened that night. But what am I to make, or what are we to make of the fact that, like, it feels for Jameis Winston like this is another universe? It's not even referred to. Every single story now I read about Jameis Winston is sort of celebrating his hot start for his NFL team, and it just, it feels as if this story has passed through the night and gone away. What is one to make of that?
Oh, I just think that's so normal. I'm not surprised by that. I do, yeah, the civil suit I think is not going to trial until next year. It's been delayed a lot. So they're actually suing each other. She sued him first. He's now, and he's suing for defamation. That's all supposed to go to trial at some point, I think, in the next year. You know, like, one of the things I think a lot about is, like, the last I heard is she lives, like, 20 miles away from the stadium that he plays in.
Wow.
It's like, that blows my mind to think of them sort of, they're in the same kind of physical space a lot. But, you know, I actually, you know, I have feelings about the Winston case, but the person I think about more is Jimbo Fisher and his role in all of this. And that's actually why I find it really hard to watch Florida State football anymore, because Winston's not there anymore.
Right.
But Fisher still is. And a lot of what came out in the reporting around this is, like, the trouble of the, you know, just, there's a lot about the Tallahassee Police Department's failures in this, but also the overlap between the athletics department and the police department in that city, you know, sort of watching, like, Fisher, like, never said anything that made me feel like he got it. at all, the seriousness of anything. I think a lot about that game the last year Winston was there before the Clemson game when he was suspended for saying that, you know, I can't remember the exact language, but it was a very sexual thing that he yelled in the cafeteria or the union or whatever, and it was inappropriate. It's like that moment when we were all like, oh, well, Winston doesn't get this. Like, he doesn't get the own seriousness of what's been going on around him. But then I think Fisher suspended him for half a game, and then they ended up lengthening that to the whole game, and everyone was so angry. And I just was like, what are you doing, man? How do you not get it? And that's, for me, the big concern. So I'm not surprised that we're not talking about it anymore, that it is about, you know, I think I say this in the book and I talk about it a lot. Sports media really does want to just talk about what happens on the field if they can get away with it. It's much more comfortable. They don't have to address the violence itself. They don't have to think about the long-term consequences. They don't have to think about the fact that she lives 20 miles away from him, all those kind of things that are uncomfortable. So I'm not surprised by any of that. And again, I would just say, like, I think a lot about Jimbo Fisher.
It's obvious that the NFL is different than college football. There are laws, obviously, for that college athletes are under, as you mentioned, Title IX, et cetera. They don't exist in the pros. But my sense is that, not my sense, I believe this. I shouldn't sort of couch the language. As a general rule, I don't believe NFL teams care about domestic violence or sexual assault or violence. I think maybe the Raiders do. They might be the one organization I think that is actually stands by what it preaches. But you have seen so many of these cases as well, Jessica. I know you might not report on the NFL the way you do college football, but what are your observations of the NFL when it comes to sexual violence, assault, and rape? Because it seems to me that it's just a continuation of how this plays out in college football, and that ultimately it's for these organizations. It's about keeping people on the field, and if somebody is a particular star, you know, as we saw in Greg Hardy, they will get far different treatment than if someone's a third or fourth string player. So it doesn't seem like anything really changes from college to the pros.
Right. No, I totally agree. I don't cover it quite as much. I mean, I wrote a fair amount about Hardy, but I, you know, like, that's one thing I like to stress about this. Like, my book is very much about how the system doesn't care about these people who report, but they also don't care about these players. Maybe on an individual case-by-case basis, they do, right? But, like, the overall idea here is to keep these guys on the field in order to sort of keep the money machine working the way it's supposed to. And I mean that both, like, for universities themselves, local communities that are built up around them, but also, like, coaches sign contracts where they get bonuses if they make it to the playoffs, win the championship. You know, there's personal incentive for those guys. They also have terrible job security. So, you know, they don't really care about these guys either. And I think that's just as clear, like, exactly like what you said on the NFL level. And, you know, I just think it's a problem within football. Like, Outside the Lines just this week had a primetime special about, you know, hazing. And I'm saying hazing in air quotes here and with high school ball. And it's actually sodomy that players are doing to other players with sexual assault. And that this is a problem in high school ball and, you know, in different places throughout the country. It's not a ton of cases, but it's enough that we should be asking, like, what the hell's going on in this culture that this is happening. So we're seeing it high school. I wrote a book about college. There's a huge discussion around what's going on the NFL level. So, you know, I just think we should be interrogating that specific culture, whatever's happening there, in more detail, right?
I have two more questions for you. And much of college football coverage is written by men. That is just a simple fact. There are women reporters who cover beats, for sure, and some women national college football writers and broadcasters, certainly. But as a general rule, it's a male-dominated media profession. And this is not to say that men cannot treat sexual violence, sexual assault, and rape with the correct perspective and empathy. But I do wonder, from your perspective, having really sort of marinated in this topic, how much does the fact that it's mostly men covering this sport impact the coverage of what you write about, college football and the politics of rape?
Oh, I mean, I definitely think that it's gendered violence that we're talking about. And I think, you know, I probably have a different relationship to it personally than men who write on this. Not necessarily so, but most likely. And one of the things that makes me hopeful, I'm like, incredibly cynical, but hopeful, is that I'll get male reporters who will contact me when suddenly it's someone on their beat who they have to write about, who's been accused, and they want to figure out how to do it the right way. And, you know, for me, when I read these stories, I'm always thinking about the person who's reported. Like, I can't not think of them as soon as I hear anything, even if I don't really know anything about them. I'm just sort of like, where are they? What's happening to them? Hope they're okay. You know, those kind of thoughts pop into my head. And I think that's not necessarily true when you're a man, you've been trained to focus on athletes and coaches and teams and athletic ability. That's not where your brain goes. And that's like my big piece of advice, is to imagine that survivors of this exact violence are going to read your stuff. I think that changes when you expand your audience. And I don't mean this to be like flippant at all. You should imagine that the very person who's reported the thing you're writing about is going to read your stuff.
Right.
Like, I know that happens. And I think when we shift that, and I think that's a useful way for men who maybe don't think about this as much as I do, just moving through the world as a woman kind of thing. I think that helps them sort of reorient themselves as they go to write, not to be unfair to the person who's been accused or anything like that, but just to be full in how they report on it, to just consider the entire audience and the entire story, which I think is often the problem, is they're not doing that.
All right, one last thing for me. And when I put out that I was going to speak to you, this question came up a couple times in different forms. And that's the toll of reporting on this kind of stuff. I teach a class at Columbia with a really good friend of mine, Jay McManus, who does
she's great.
Yeah, similar reporting that you do. And we've talked about this. And there are times I know from her that it's the reporting takes a lot out of you emotionally. And it's exhausting, mm-hmm. and it wears on people in the same way. And it's not the same thing, but it's sort of the same feeling that war reporting and civil conflict reporting takes a lot out of the people who are in those conflict areas. You know, you're away from home. You're dealing with just horrible stuff day after day. So for you, you're reporting and writing on some really, really hard and horrific topics. One, how do you get away from it? And two, do you ever worry that it becomes too much for you to report and too exhausting that you're almost sort of mentally have to get away from it just to sort of survive in your own personal life? I wonder if these are, and I didn't really ask that question great, but I just wonder if these are things you think about, because having talked to other reporters who deal with very hard topics, a lot of times there's a shelf life in their career because they can't do it for so long because it eventually just emotionally and mentally grinds them down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The first time that I worked directly with a survivor to tell a story was back in the fall of 2014. And that was when I also learned what secondary trauma is, which is like you start to take on, you know, you hear people's trauma repeatedly. So like in that case, you know, I interviewed her, I don't know, 6 hours. Like you could go over what happened to her repeatedly over and over again. I talked to her about it. I read the documents that I had, like, I was taking in so much violence and then also the repercussions of that for this person. And you do start to feel bad. You know, I have my own mental health struggles that probably don't help me in any of this stuff, but it can be so difficult. Like right now with the book tour, like I'm incredibly grateful for people caring about this topic and wanting to talk about it. But I literally talk about rape like for hours all day long. And then when I do that, the response to it is often that I get people who contact me to tell me their stories. So either them or their moms, I get a lot of moms
right.
who contact me to tell me about their daughters. And so I'm just taking in story after story. And a lot of those people who contact me don't want to go to they don't want to tell it publicly. They just want to tell someone they think will say, I'm sorry that happened, you know, with care. And I'm happy to do that, but that does mean I'm just taking it in all the time. I'm reading horrible stuff all the time. I always know way more about something than what I've reported about it. You know, you can only report so much and fact checking and all this sort of stuff, but I always know so much more. I get sad a lot about it. I have to step away. I've had to learn to recognize that it's happening and to give myself permission to slow down. Like, I feel like there's pressure because publishing and how it works, like, you got to get the story, you got to write it, it's got to be real fast, turn it over. And like, I will have moments where I will read a police report of a horrible thing that has happened to somebody. And I have to just say, like, okay, I have to not do this story now for like the next 3 days. Like, I just need to give myself a break from this. And so I do worry that I won't be able to do this for very long, because it just sucks sometimes. This is hard. And of course, there's always the balance of thinking, like, I always think this is not as, like, whatever I'm going through is not as bad as what has happened to these people that I'm reporting about. I will step away. I will, like, I think during, we were reporting Baylor last August. We got the tip on August 5th. We published on August 20th. You know, we went to the trial in the meantime. I was doing a bunch of interviews with people, you know, lots of stuff. But also in there, I binge watched the first season of The Flash. Like, we had like a day where nothing was happening.
Right.
And I just sat on my couch and like watched The Flash, and it was really great. I people who follow me on Twitter and know anything, I read tons of romance novels. Like, I will stop in the middle of the day and just like go read a book that I know I love. And like, my brain will sort of slow down and let me do that. I try to report on stuff that's not sad. I had an editor once. I took a story to him and I was like, hey, can I write on this? And he was like, yes, it is a happy story. Like, I'm happy to pay you to write on this happy story. So I do try to find stuff. It's hard, though. It's hard. There's an inertia to this that I didn't expect. You know, I go on Outside the Lines to talk about one story, and I get off national TV, and I already have an email from someone telling me about their story. And it's like, it's hard to get out of it. So, yeah, I don't know. Does that answer the question? Like, it's very difficult work, and I think that's something you have to be prepped for, and I didn't understand that when I got into it. I didn't understand how hard it would be to get out of it. I actually don't know how to get out of it at this point. I don't think I'm ready to, but it is something I think a lot about.
Yeah, no, that answers it really well, and it's, you know, obviously it's sort of an internal thing that I can imagine you think about, but the work is really, really important, and I know you know that, and I think there are a lot of people out there who are really glad that you're doing it. It's not we're so happy and psyched. These are not happy stories, but they have to be told and they have to be reported on in order for things to change. And one of the big things in your book is you do offer sort of a new playbook where a lot of it is preventive education, and it's well worth people reading. The book is on sportsmanlike conduct, college football, and the politics of rape. Jessica Luther is the author, and she's also been the guest. She writes on this topic and reports on this topic at essentially the highest levels in this country. She's doing really important work, and I'm glad that there was timing here that we could have her on the podcast, because she's somebody I've wanted to talk to for a while. Jessica, thank you so much for your time and for your reporting and for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Jessica Luther. Again, her book is on sportsmanlike conduct, college football, and the politics of rape. I certainly recommend the book, and I certainly recommend her writing. It's really, really important work that she's doing, and you would be wise to check it out. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, and others. My thanks to all who have put this podcast together. We have a new production group, so I'll learn everybody's name eventually. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.